It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on New Year's Eve. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert has the day off. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk to a WPR reporter who's been covering the booming frac sand industry over the last year. He'll round up the biggest stories and give us a preview of what's to come in 2014. First, the holidays can be a great time to sit down with friends and family to share food and conversation, but our next guest says it's time to consider a new subject around the dinner table, philosophy, and she says doing so can really enrich our lives. A few months back, I spoke with Marietta McCarty, author of The Philosopher's Table, about the idea of philosophy dinner clubs. I'm not a big philosopher myself, so I started by asking her how she defines philosophy and why she thought we need it in our daily lives.
I found in the study of philosophy how very practical and useful it was for me. And I define it as the art of clear thinking. It's emptying the mind of the clutter and the noise and the unfounded opinions and assumptions we may have and making room for more clarity about ideas that are really essential to good living, gratitude, generosity, humility, whatever that may be, how to simplify our lives. And I think it's really unfortunate that I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, oh, philosophy, I remember that course I took for a couple of months in college. And really it is so useful. I think people really like to come together and have conversation and communicate in a genuine kind of way and think about the good life and what our priorities should be. And whether it's the children I've taken philosophy to, my college students, or the many, many diners and readers who keep in touch with me, they're finding that how much this is nourishing their lives to come together, learn about other cultures, and to talk about ideas that really matter. So in my book, I've chosen 12 topics and 12 places in the world so that dinner clubs can meet once a month and experience January in Japan, let's say, or September in Kenya, and talk about a topic, talk about the culture, listen to some music from that culture, and then eat some food. And the world becomes much bigger and also in a way much more intimate.
Why food? Why is food such an important part of the equation here?
Well, discussion and conversation have always been a part of philosophizing for me. And solitude is great, reflection is key, but sometimes we discover things together that can't be delivered by solitude. And what brings people together better than food? I think that, we have the expression comfort food. Maybe all food is comfort food. The soothing atmosphere, the carafes being passed, the bread is breaking. And I think food is an icebreaker, and I think it's a relationship maker. I think that food is something happens when we come together and eat and pass the something at the table and take time to be together.
You've been doing these philosophy dinner clubs, right? You didn't just start this for the book. This is something that's part of your life, isn't it?
That's right.
And do your friends, are they suspicious when you invite them over for supper? Is the food just a bait, but they know, oh, she's gonna bring up some philosophical issue and throw it at us?
Well, I've managed to work it that I'm usually the one that's invited to their
house. Aha.
So that's working really well for me. And what people are doing in my town, here in Charlottesville in Virginia, is they've started these dinner clubs, and many of them are ongoing. And what this book does is it sort of gives them permission to try recipes and things that they might not have made before. And the topics that I've chosen that I think are so important, they are topics that I think we should be able to talk about. Well, persistence and grace, for example, simple pleasures is another one, decision making. They're not necessarily political, they're not religious, they're things that I think in my travels with philosophy are important to be talked about. So my friends aren't suspicious, they sort of know what's going to happen, and they're very eager for it. In preparation, in writing this book, Rob, I had people all over the country cooking and testing and tweaking the recipes and actually having the dinner parties with the particular topic in mind. And, oh, the pure pleasure they derived from it was incredible. The stories that were told, the relationships that were formed. So it's just wonderful information coming back my way.
So let's talk through how a dinner night, a philosophy dinner night, might work. You mentioned September was a Kenyan theme. Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
If I'm a guest, do I have to do some homework before I show up?
Yes, you do.
Uh-oh.
But it's very pleasant. It's not homework as we think of it. So here's basically what we would have for that chapter. The topic is a fruitful ecological solution. And I turn to one of my favorite philosophers, Wangari Maathai, from Kenya. And so I talk about why this issue has proven important in my philosophy travels. The issues that are in the book are all weighing on people's minds. So we know that we have environmental issues both in our homes and in our local communities and globally. So I talk a bit about the issue. And then I have a section called Prepping for Kenya. So there are things that you can read. There are things that you could go online, for example, and check out the Masai Mara National Reserve. There are movies you can watch. The wonderful movie, The First Grader, directed by Justin Chadwick, which is a marvelous film to be introduced to Kenya. And then I introduce the reader to the philosopher, to Wangari Maathai, and her take on this issue and how she addressed Kenya's very dramatic, overwhelming ecological issues. And so that's what the homework would be, and what you know is what the dinner topic will be. So I give the topic, it's a quote from her, from Maathai, and sort of set up what the conversation might be like for dinner. And then philosophy dinner clubs almost always, in my experience, rotate who's hosting it, but there are lots of suggestions for what guests can bring. So you can bring boiled peanuts, let's say, or grilled plantains, or Maathai loved figs. And so there are suggestions for what the guests bring, and then also music. And a lot of people like to listen to the music to get into the mood before the dinner. And then the recipes that the host would provide. And for Kenya, it's squash and apple soup. Both squash and apples are so important in that particular culture. And so people can learn about where the food is coming from and shop for it and that sort of thing. And then one of the most popular recipes in the book is No Need African Seed Bread. And that's the other thing that the host would fix. And then at the end, Rob, there's Kenya to go, and there are more things that you might want to read, more things to listen to, some more music perhaps. Maathai often referred to herself as a hummingbird, and so there's a movie that you can look at that explains why. She said the hummingbird just does the best it can. That's all any of us can do, is the best we can when it comes to the environment. And then it finishes with the resources that were used in that chapter. So it does require a commitment of time on the part of the diners that they are going to read about the topic. They're going to think about it. They're going to make the appetizers, pick up the appetizers, and participate and give it their full attention. I think that's universally what I'm hearing from around the country, is that when you do make this commitment that once a month we're going to do this and it's going to matter and we're going to learn from each other, that's the trick, is making the commitment of time.
How do you pick that guest list of people who you're going to ask to make that commitment?
Well, people are doing a variety of things. Some people are mixing it up and say maybe a couple of family members, a neighbor or two, a couple of colleagues. Some people are inviting, the recipes serve eight, and some people are choosing four people, three people, something like that, and then they pick somebody. So it's people who didn't know each other before. So there are a lot of different ways to go about choosing who you might want to have, and the important thing is to make sure that they are looking for this good conversation and will make the commitment of time.
So you sit people down. They're not philosophers. In your experience, how long does it take before that conversation really gets rolling?
Well, if I've done my job, it shouldn't take very long because in talking about the issue, whatever that may be, say persistence and grace, I explain why it's an issue, write about it in a way that should help people talk about it. And I think that, you know, if philosophy is the art of clear thinking, then I think we all have the potential to philosophize. I remember I was giving a talk once, and there were some child philosophers there. They were in the third grade, and they did philosophy three times a week at their school. And so I was speaking to an adult audience, but they were there. So I asked the children, I said, do you have anything you'd like to say to the group? And one child said, yes, I would like to say, don't feel that you can't do philosophy just because you're a grown-up. So children do philosophy. They're natural philosophers. We all have the ability to think and reflect. I think we're starved for good conversation. The world's very noisy, and we're moving really fast. And to sit down and spend time together, I think, fulfills a real, it's soul food, and I think that's what we're hungry for.
Are kids ever part of these?
Well, not, I mean, everywhere I go, pretty much, you know, whether it's a picnic with children or whatever, usually there's some food involved with them. I think it's possible for children to be involved, although I wasn't thinking about including them when I was writing the book, but I don't think it's out of the question at all.
That's Marietta McCarty. She's author of The Philosopher's Table. We'll have the second half of that interview coming up in just a moment. And if you've tried out a philosophy dinner club, we'd love to hear about it. Post a picture of your event or tell us about it on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, here's a look at some of the latest news with WPR's Kristen Durst. We're talking to Marietta McCarty. Her book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club. She's got philosophical questions, a little background research, and recipes to pull together a group of eight or so people and chat about philosophy. Marietta, what do we get? I tend to think of philosophy as a solitary activity. You mentioned that a little earlier. What do we learn when we start talking about these ideas with other people around the dinner table?
Well, I think, in a way, stories aren't just about our lives. They are our lives. And I think the narrative that happens when people are gathered around the dinner table is so important. So, for example, the first chapter is the joy of single tasking, doing one thing at a time and doing it well rather than running in many different directions. And so I think when people share anecdotes or things that they would like to do or what makes them this difficult for them to slow down and concentrate and be attentive to the moment, that we learn so much from each other. And what many diners are telling me is that they're learning about not only the people at the dinner table with them, but they're learning about themselves. They're learning that, you know, they had ideas that you know, were faulty, things are opening up, new possibilities will present themselves for better living. And what drove the book, Rob, wasn't the food. The food is what brings people together, but it's the topics that drove the book. I think they're the ones that people really would like to talk about.
And do you see a lot of sort of breakthrough moments as people are talking and maybe something that had been muddling around in their brain for a while starts to gel as they're talking about it with other people at the dinner club?
Oh, absolutely. For example, in the chapter on persistence and grace, I talk in that chapter about anger and its futility and what unchecked anger can do to our lives. And so with this sort of analysis of anger and the damage that it does comes this realization that, you know, I can do better than that. I don't need that. And the philosopher I use is from Burma is Aung San Suu Kyi, who in her nonviolent, passionate, resilient way has broken through the military dictatorship there and opened that country to democracy. It's a powerful lesson in persistence and grace and what can be done when anger is controlled. Suu Kyi asks questions. She wants to get to know people who disagree with her. Her goal is not to prove that she's right. So I think what happens, I'm hoping for at dinner tables, and what I enjoy seeing so much, Rob, is what I would call a soft relationship, that you have this ease at the dinner table of yielding and listening. I mean, you know, we don't listen very well, and we need to learn to listen again and let people say what they have to say and have thoughts hang there and ask questions. Questions are much more interesting than than statements. And so there's a certain tone and temperament that happens. And I hear all the time, you know, people are, when they think about simple pleasures and what really matters, and they choose to restore friendships because they realize that that's really life's greatest simple pleasure in many ways, and it doesn't cost a thing except our time. So I've seen radical changes in people's lives, and I've also seen slow, steady changes in people's lives, and it's all done in a happy atmosphere. Sometimes it's emotional when people are sharing things from their past, but it's always with one giant step forward as you push your chair back from the dinner table.
I wonder, though, I mean, you mentioned this ease of a conversation, this mellow environment, but it's, for me, I think I'd feel a little awkward. You know, I've got these people who I usually talk about the Packer game and the weather with, and we're now talking about these deep issues, or maybe a total stranger I've never met, and we're trying to figure out how these deep issues affect our daily lives. How long does it take to overcome that initial, what I would see as awkwardness?
Well, there are a lot of suggestions in the book for how to do that and what it means to have a good conversation. I talk about up front in the first chapter on the joy of single-tasking. I don't find, Rob, in my experience, that it is hard for people. I think, you know, maybe the third dinner will be a little easier than the first one. But when you're talking about a philosophy course in college and you're talking about deep issues which may be abstract and removed from someone's life, that's not like talking about, let's say, the chapter set in China is a slow dance with nature, and it's talking about the reality that everything changes and the one constant in life is change. And so how much easier and better would our lives be if we could accept that and give newness a try and give change a try each day of our lives, because that is the reality and the damage that comes from pretending that anything can stay the same forever. So I don't think of these as deep issues in that they're difficult to discuss. I think of them as priority issues on the path towards good living. And what I see with each dinner is that clarity improves. Minds get sharper, questions get better. It's just easier to have a conversation. And you're right, what might make you feel awkward at that first dinner is that we don't sit down and talk with each other at length very often. And so getting used to that, I think, is the biggest thing. But people are drawn to it. They savor it. And that's why it's important that the people that you have in your group want to make this commitment. So the kind of tone and temperament I'm talking about at the table comes from a willingness to listen and not to prove a point, not to be right, but just to continue to talk about the topic and understand it better.
One of the toughest topics for me to grasp looking through the suggested was you had a chapter a month on with Immanuel Kant, who I don't get. And on the upside, for us in Wisconsin, you gave us some bait. You included brats on the menu.
I know. I know. Well, I haven't been to Wisconsin, but if I ever do, I want to be welcome there. So I knew that I had to have brats in the book for you. I didn't mention the Green Bay Packers. I there was no way I could do that. But yeah, but the food is the thing that really makes it work. You know, I went to one town and did two book events of the same day. One had food and one didn't. A lot of the people were the same. The event that had food that brought people together who did not know each other was completely different. It had a feel to it that invited people to speak and open up and talk with each other and know that they would be respected. Nobody was trying to win a debate. So Immanuel Kant, most people don't get him. He made sure in his writing that not very many people would understand him, but that's why I have a job, is making it. What he's saying is not that complicated, and it is very interesting to think about what drives the decisions we make. Is it emotion? Do we think about the consequences? Do we think about motivation? Those are things that it's easy to talk about, and I hope it's easy to talk about, and that's my goal with the book.
As part of your wider mission of bringing philosophy into our daily lives, how do you think we ended up with this separation where some of us think philosophy isn't relevant and we don't talk about these things?
To be perfectly honest, I think that what happened is, and this often happens in academia, is that the topic itself becomes removed from the lives of ordinary people and becomes sort of the province of this academic club. And so what makes that club going, it keeps it going and makes the membership secure, is that you've got this body of knowledge that's yours, and you know what it is, and it belongs with you, and you impart it to your students, and they give you the information back that you're imparting to them. That's the antithesis of what I think the art of clear thinking is. I think it's about discussion. My students and readers say they love it that I am learning with them, which I certainly am. This has been a very, in a way, selfish journey for me because I learn all the time. So I think that there has been some intentional desire to make, you know, you feel that you can't go to an art gallery, for example. The art critics might make you feel that way, that you can't go to opera because you haven't really studied it. You can't do philosophy because it was too complicated in college, and I think that that's really unfortunate. And I think that we need to come together and think again.
That was Marietta McCarty, author of The Philosopher's Table. She joined us for that interview back in September. Coming up, a look at the year in the booming frac sand industry in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. First, we continue this week's look back at the top stories in Wisconsin with a look at the booming sand extraction industry. The sand is mined here in Wisconsin and sent out of the state to be used in hydraulic fracturing of natural gas and oil. That's better known as fracking. WPR reporter Rich Kramer is our man on the frack sand, and he joins us now to look at how the industry grew over the year and the controversies it raised. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
So first of all, did we see big growth in the industry over the course of 2013?
I would say we did. The last numbers that I had, and this was towards the beginning of 2013, was that there were about 160-some-odd operations. That's, mines processing facilities where they wash the sand, and also the rail loadout where they get it on the rail cars and send it off to Texas and Pennsylvania and North Dakota, where have you. But now it looks like that number has jumped to 224, but that doesn't mean that there are 224 sand mines actually digging. What the DNR says is that there's 61 mines, 43 processing centers, and 28 shipping operations actually operational. But there are another 57 proposed developing mines across the state, 28 processing operations and shipping operations. So total permits that are out there, total possibility is 224, and that's a big jump.
And it sounds like with a lot of those permits in the works, actual extraction could go up more in 2014.
It could. It all depends on, supply and demand. It depends on what the prices are for natural gas. That's been pretty low. But what I think we'll see in 2014 is a lot of these mines that and planned operations, they'll start to open up and start getting more product out.
Well, that growth in the sand mining has led to a growth in reaction from local citizens and local governments. What kind of things have we seen on the local level in the neighborhood of these frac sand operations?
Well, as far as citizens, they've been concerned from day one. Way back in 2008, we started hearing people worried about the noise. They started worrying about the dust, which can cause some troubles if you breathe it in. So if you get high concentrations of the silica dust in your lungs. But local governments have really kind of clamped down a little bit. It started, in 2011, 2012 with some towns using police powers to create ordinances that would regulate these companies. But it ramped up big time this year with we had the towns of Pepin and Stockholm along the Great River Road, kind of in the Mississippi Lake Pepin area. They passed a 10-mile zone where no frac sand mining was allowed. They didn't officially ban it because they'd probably get sued instantly, but they banned any operation, any facility, any company that had more than 50 truck trips per day coming in and out of the facility. And sand mining usually requires hundreds of truck trips. Trempealeau County passed a one-year moratorium, and they also changed their permits to kind of clamp down on people, their permit process on people that would get a permit and then kind of sit on it and not do anything with that. If they sit longer than 12 months, they lose it. So there has been, there are other examples, obviously, but there has been some crackdown.
And then companies have responded to this at the local level. We'll get to the state level in a minute. But they've tried, I gather, to get some towns to annex land from the county to exempt themselves from those regulations. Is that right?
That's right. You're in the right direction, in the right ballpark. It's actually they're annexing from towns to cities. But the annexation, basically, if a frac sand company has any part of its property that actually touches a city limit, they can petition the city to annex their land. And if they annex their land, then the frac sand company, which may already have an agreement with the town that they're located in, they have kind of a clean slate, and they can work with the city to get regulations that are more favorable for them. The big sticking point so far, and there have been a number of annexations. In 2012, there were a couple. This year, there were at least three that I know of and one pending. But hours of operation seem to be a big sticking point. They want to run 24/7 and get as much product out as they can. And a lot of towns in Trempealeau County itself, which is zoned countywide, they've been reluctant to do that. They've only let them operate 12 or 16 hours.
And then at the state level, there's some legislation afoot that would render a lot of that local, a lot of those local ordinances moot. Is that right?
Yeah, that there's going to be some more kicks at the cat, but what was introduced is something called Senate Bill 349, SB 349. The official title is the Regulatory Certainty Act, and that was introduced by Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany and Republican State Representative Joan Ballweg. And their aim, their claimed goal, is to kind of create some more uniformity as far as regulations so that you don't have one town being, you know, having one set of regulations, then the town right next door could have a totally different set of regulations. They argued that this was, you know, kind of ridiculous for the industry and was a burden. So they said to fix that, the state will just take over and they will, the towns won't be able to regulate anything, really, as far as frac sand mining is concerned. And that has been very controversial.
And that is not a done deal. Where does that sit right now?
It's still in committee. I don't know the name of the committee offhand, but it was introduced to committee, and then it has to pass that. There's going to be a lot more changes. Tom Tiffany told me that he's working with towns. He's working with the towns association, the counties association, frac sand companies. He's getting everyone together to try to craft something that it maintains the intent of the legislation to create uniformity, but also leaves the local control intact as possible, which is very, very important for local governments.
And while all this is going on, the DNR has been keeping an eye on the industry. What has gone on in 2013 from the DNR point of view?
Well, first off, the DNR got a couple extra helpers to keep an eye on air permits. The frac sand companies get air permits. They discharge basically soot. They've got these large heaters that dry the frac sand, but also the air permits deal with just total dust that is present. If stuff gets too dusty, and we're talking dust the size of particulate matter 10 or 10 microns, big chunks of dust. If it's way too dusty, they can come down and issue a notice of violation. So they got two additional staff members. They asked the governor for that, and he obliged. It was at a cost of around $200,000. But the DNR also had big news recently. This spring, a really heavy rainstorm. DNR threw out six violations because of stormwater runoff. And, of course, the big news was the Department of Justice announced that a judge had basically, for lack of a better term, fined one company $200,000 for stormwater discharges in Trempealeau County. There's another company that was accused of violating air permits, and they had to pay $80,000 to the state.
And then looking ahead at 2014 as we wrap up, do you see more enforcement action like this being pretty likely?
Well, we'll see. these companies, they don't, even though $200,000 might not seem like a lot for a company that makes millions and millions of dollars, or tens or hundreds of millions perhaps, but they still don't want to be making these, paying these fines. So they're continually trying to tweak their mines and their processing centers so they can contain that stormwater. I think we'll see less operations getting fines. A lot of the violations have to do with companies just building too quickly or you know, doing something before they get a permit. And I think that that's going to kind of slow down.
Rich, thanks a lot and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer joining us from our Eau Claire studio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A Wisconsin research effort aims to fight a disease in Africa not with antibiotics or high-tech surgical devices, but with flip-flops. Tony Goldberg is in the studio. He's a professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison, and he's the associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Before we get to the flip-flops, do you see a trend toward trying to find inexpensive kind of lifestyle solutions to health problems around the world?
Absolutely. I think it may be a coming wave. You know, we've had a lot of technological development in health and medicine over the last century. And now in a lot of places, our biggest impediment is trying to get the technology that already exists to be adopted well by the communities that need it. So that's a huge challenge, every bit as large as developing the technologies in the first place.
Well, tell us about the disease you're trying to fight and the people who suffer from it.
So the disease we're targeting is in general called soil-transmitted helminths. And most people will be aware of hookworm mm-hmm. as a great example of that. There's a number of helminths or worms that have stages that live in the soil and can get into your body either through burrowing through your feet or if you accidentally ingest soil. This is a worldwide disease, most common in the tropics. We do have it here in the U.S., and it's been historically and recently a big problem all across the world.
And you're working in Uganda in particular, is that right?
That's correct. My team's working in Uganda, and I've been working there for over 20 years running a long-term research project, so we're familiar with the communities in that area. Although this the idea we're testing and the disease we're looking at are not only in that area of the world.
Mm-hmm. So the holoflip or hollow flip, how do you say it?
We've come up with the name holoflop.
Flop, okay. So tell us about it. What is it and why are you hopeful that it might make a difference?
Well, the way to prevent soil-transmitted helminths is pretty simple. You simply block them from getting into your feet. And a tried-and-true technology for doing that is the simple flip-flop-style sandal. That's been known for a long time. So the solution is there. The problem is how do you get people to wear these flip-flops in the right place at the right time and to understand why they should do it? So our innovation is to actually put a message telling people how they should wear flip-flops and why they should wear flip-flops on the flip-flop itself. And the way we're going to do that is by creating a very interesting image that depicts the benefits of wearing those flip-flops that we stick on the shoes.
So, and the people in the area you're working in, flip-flops are a common footwear. This is not a new invention for them, but they don't necessarily wear them when they need them, right?
That's right. Flip-flops and similar shoes are really common all throughout sub-Saharan Africa, but they're also not accessible financially for a lot of people. So one problem is that people may have a perfectly good pair of shoes, but they're not willing to wear them in the places that are kind of dirty where they might be infected. They save them for special occasions, maybe like church or other places like that.
Right. So I can only afford one pair of these things. I don't want to wear them where they're going to get messed up. And the place they're going to get messed up is the most likely place to catch this disease.
That's exactly right. So our solution to that is we're going to try to create an educational technology that's going to at least give people the information to understand the situations under which flip-flop wearing would be most beneficial.
So an obvious question would be, why not just a printed label, a text label on this?
Well, a couple of reasons. These have to be on shoes, so that we have to pack a lot of information into a very small space. And it just turns out there are some image technologies available these days that have gotten to the point where you can create almost a proto-animation effect on a printed image. We call our shoe the Holoflop, it's not actually a hologram. The thing we're creating is called a lenticular image. And you may remember these from greeting cards or advertisements where it's an image where you look at it one way, it looks like one thing, then you turn it a little bit at an angle and it flips to something else. Mm-hmm. These have come a long way. They're printed on a special type of paper with lenses in a line that are on different planes. So that creates the flip or animation effect. We're going to see if we can pack a whole lot of information to depict the benefits of wearing these shoes in one of these images that can be put on the shoe itself.
So you've got an idea like this. You've got the product, the whole HoloFlop. How do you put it into practice and make sure it works?
Well, that's the focus of our project. We're funded by the Gates Foundation, who's all about new technologies or getting technologies accepted across the world. And our plan is to actually trial test this in Uganda. So we're developing the shoe itself. We're developing the image. We're working with some graphic designers. We're working with some shoe companies. And our idea is to distribute this new technology and to do two things. First of all, to measure scientifically whether or not it changes people's risk of acquiring these soil-transmitted helminths, as we predict it should. But on top of that, I'm working with my postdoctoral researcher, Sarah Page, who's an expert in public health and medical geography. And she's going to be leading a component of the study that's going to look at why people do or do not accept this technology and how well they understand the image. So our idea here is that it's not enough to simply create a new technology. Really, if you're going to create it and deploy it, you want to understand why it works as well as if it works.
That's one of the most fascinating things to me about medicine and public health. Even though you have a solution, whether it's flip-flops or it's a medication or a procedure or a test, you have to be anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, too, to make sure that it somehow fits into the local culture and the local lifestyle.
Well, I think that's a very astute observation, and I'm proud to say that my PhD is actually in anthropology of all
really?
Things. It is, yeah. So I think this particular case of the HoloFlop is a special case of a general phenomenon, which is the acceptance or non-acceptance of new medical technologies. And we see this all over the place. We see it in the United States with, for example, vaccines. You know, there are vaccines out there that are very effective for preventing certain infectious diseases, and yet there are people who elect not to use them, even though the risks of adverse effects to the vaccines are far smaller than the risks of getting the disease that the vaccines are designed to prevent. Why is that? That's not really a question for people working in labs on developing new vaccines. It's more of a question for anthropologists, sociologists, political scientists. And I think if we can understand that, that's every bit as important as understanding the technological barriers to healthcare.
Have we had a lot of flops? Sorry, not the flip-flop kind, but in the sense of failure when it comes to medical technologies. We've got this great idea, and maybe we even ship it to Area X, whatever that might be, but nobody did that work, that groundwork first to make sure how it fits in?
There's a long list of examples of that, failed medical technology deployment. One that comes to mind off the top of my head are bed nets for malaria. Now, sleeping under a net is a great way to prevent a mosquito from biting you in the middle of the night and transmitting malaria. And a lot of people have had the idea, well, let's just get a whole bunch of bed nets mm-hmm. and throw them out there in some community that's having a malaria problem. And that sounds like a great idea, but what happens in some cases is that people will use the bed nets for other things. For example, for fishing as a fishing net, or for, you know, they might sell it because, of course, and they have to weigh the economic benefits of selling the net versus preventing a disease that they may not be able to prevent anyway. Often, from a public health perspective, the best use of things like bed nets would be to protect mothers and their infants. And yet, in some places in the world, you know, other people in the household sort of have priority and might use the net. So,
like maybe the person who is the breadwinner for the household.
That's exactly.
And you've got to keep them healthy or nobody eats or something like
that. That's exactly right. So a lot of these great technologies that sound terrific on paper don't pan out exactly as you would predict. It kind of spirals, and you see this time and time again. So I think by coupling these deployments of these new technologies with these kind of piggyback studies of social acceptance, that really increases your bang for the buck.
And you've got this support from the Gates Foundation. Is this reflective of an understanding of what you're talking about here, of the need to match the technology to the culture?
I hope so. We were funded through the Gates Foundation by their Grand Challenge Grand Challenge's Explorations Program, which is all about the development and deployment of novel medical technologies. I hope that our award and some others that have also been awarded do indicate an appreciation of this need to study social acceptance along with the technologies themselves.
And you're down in the dirt, literally, on this project, but are you preaching the gospel here to other people in the public health community that we need to make these connections?
I think for some people I am preaching the gospel, mm-hmm. and that's not always a bad thing to do, but mm-hmm. I think there are other sectors of the healthcare community that need this idea reinforced. You know, there's a lot of money being spent on developments of new technologies, new drugs, new vaccines, new information technologies. And it's not always clear that people are giving the same amount of attention to the impediments to deploying those technologies.
In our last 30 seconds or so, as you move forward, what does success look like with this flip-flop program?
I think success would be twofold. It would be a demonstration that the technology works to reduce Helminth infection. But also, I think it would be a recognition that it works the way we think it's going to work, that the image we design will convey to people the benefits of wearing these shoes under the right circumstances, and it will be a socially accepted thing that may grow to have a life of its own.
Tony, thanks a lot for joining us on the show.
You're very welcome.
That's Tony Goldberg. He's professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison, also associate director for research at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute.